This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you tonight from our Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and those of you tuning into our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF is a wonderful organization that provides financial assistance to riders who have given everything to the sport. If you are able to help, please visit the website www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening has, in my opinion, the greatest comeback story I have ever heard. He was one of the top riders in the nation at the time of his spill in 2005. He did not know if he would be able to walk again, much less ride again, but here he is, ladies and gentlemen, riding better than ever with 3,365 wins and counting, over $68 million in earnings. Gary Boulanger, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule, Gary. And you're riding up, you're joining us from Canada, actually. And tell us, how was your weekend?
Weekend was okay. I went a few races, ran third in one stake and third in another stake. And been a really good year this year. I mean, a lot of nice horses, and it's been a lot of fun.
That's awesome, Gary. And you were actually from Canada. You were born there, correct?
I was born in Alberta, yeah.
And so tell us, how did you get involved in the sport? How did you first become introduced to racing?
Well, I was always very in love with horses from a young age. My uncles and them had show horses and cutting horses and halter horses and quarter horses, and I was always doing anything to get to their farm to just be around them. And at about the age of 17, some people seeing me at a cutting event and asked me if I'd ever thought about becoming a jockey. And I said, yeah, but I didn't know how to get involved because I had no family involved in racing. And we were from an oil kind of community, small little hobby farms. And they introduced me to racing, and I rode the little B tracks in Alberta, like Red Deer, Lethbridge, Lloydminster, or Grand Prairie. There's little quarter horses and thoroughbreds and some Arabians and stuff like that. And there's no apprenticeships. It's just catch weight. And I rode there for that summer and started that way.
So tell me, I'm fascinated, Gary, by the bush tracks, I guess you could call them, there in Canada, and we've had several riders here on the show from Louisiana who rode at the bush tracks down there, and of course, as you mentioned, it's kind of it's a little different than paramutual racing and what we see now. But tell us about those bush tracks, and how was it getting started there, and was it pretty tough?
Well, anything like this. I mean, racing's tough itself, and I mean, it was there are weekend meets, and they're on little half-mile, five-eighths of a mile track. You got to ride with some older riders that couldn't make the weight anymore on the big circuit, like Edmonton and Calgary was the two big tracks in Alberta. And they come, you weren't riding for a lot of money. I mean, it was $15 a mountain, $30 a win. But you gained a lot of knowledge and experience, and it was, I mean, there was nothing easy. I mean, you got up early every morning and you galloped a lot of horses and breezed a lot of horses and didn't have no agent, just the people that you see, and they would, yeah, I'm going to ride, they run this horse in here, and kind of showed up at the draw, or they entered them, and you seen that you were on them. I mean, it was kind of a little fair, kind of fun thing, but it was a lot of learning and knowledge I learned there.
Did they have stewards there, or was it pretty much anything goes?
No, they had stewards, and they had paramutual wagering. You could bet, and but there was no recognized apprenticeship there, so you didn't jeopardize losing or starting your bug. So it was a good learning grounds to go to. But they had two stewards there, and they had a starter and a placing judge, and you know, clerk of scale. You stepped on a bathroom scale, and as long as it registered over, I think it was 120 or 130. You're good, you know, and you tacked your own horse. You had no valid.
Wow.
And there was like one set of silks, 1 through 8, and one set of saddle towels. So every race you'd come and you'd change, you'd grab the number 8 silk and the number 8 saddle towel, and you'd tack your horse up.
Wow. Did they have a jocks room?
They had a little trailer, yeah, that had just like benches you sat in, and you, there was maybe an outhouse or a bathroom, depending on what facility we were at. And some of them had showers, some of them didn't. Like Teepee Creek didn't have showers. It was pretty bushy, but it was, like I said, it was a lot of fun and a lot of learning, and it was a great experience.
So, Gary, you started out riding cutting horses and introduced to quarter horses and horses like that, and then you end up at the bush tracks. And how was that transition? And obviously you said it was a half-mile track, so that's a totally different style of riding when you're riding at a bull ring like that. It's a little bit different. And how was that transition? Was it hard to adjust, or was it overwhelming at times to be faced with, obviously the bull rings are very dangerous too. Was it overwhelming?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't know any different when I first went. So, I mean, all I knew was the little half mile tracks, right? So once I started it out, it was, you know, that's all you knew. So that's what you're accustomed to. And then when you got to, when I come to the States and started my apprenticeship down in the States, and, the first place I went to was Tampa, so it was a big mile track, you know, and it's all thoroughbreds, and at that time they had some Arabian racing there as well. So, you know, you're just kind of you're more used to how long of a stretch you had in comparison, and, you know, how many less times you had to go around there going a mile 16th, you know, it's like, oh, this is once around instead of 3.5 times around. I mean, it was a welcome change, but, you know, there's a lot of questions asked on things over the years, learning pace and judging pace and judging, you know, making your moves when you got there, right? And that came over years and years of riding, but initially you didn't know any different, so it was, you're pretty excited to get on a mile track. You thought that was pretty neat, and it was a lot of fun, and the more you rode, the more experience you gained, and I was fortunate enough to have more races I won.
So eventually, as you mentioned, Gary, you moved to the States, and as you said before as well, you were riding at the bush tracks, but you didn't have to risk losing your apprenticeship. So you had all this experience, but it wasn't counting against you, and so you go to the States, and so how long did it take for you to win your first race in the States?
First mountain I rode.
Wow. That's impressive. It was
actually an Arabian for the people that brought me to the States. And I think I win the first 5 out of 12 races I rode.
Wow.
So then, you know, it was a lot of fun. And I got to, I mean, I was fortunate enough that I got to go to a lot of different places, and I went pretty much everywhere I went, and I wasn't winning a lot, but I was winning. And I thought I was very fortunate to just be a jockey, you know, and have a job that you truly love to do, which made it so easy for me to, you know, like there was no struggle getting up in the morning. There was no struggle getting on horses. You know, as many as I could find to get on, that's how many I'd get on.
Right. When you love it, you want to
get as many, enough of it.
Exactly. Now, Gary, when you were starting out, did you ever think about the dangers involved with the sport? Obviously, it's the only sport where an ambulance follows you around the track. So did you ever think about that before getting involved?
Well, I mean, I think in any sport there's dangers. And I mean, we'd always ask questions. And all the older guys and trainers and riders that I talked to, you know, it's not if you get hurt, it's how bad. If you ride long enough, you're going to get hurt.
Right.
It's just how bad you get hurt. And so you always knew that you were in a very high-risk sport. And if you're scared, you better not go out there. So, I mean, there's never been an inkling of a thought of me being scared out there. That's my comfort zone. I mean, I'm on a horse and I'm in a race. I'm totally at ease with myself. And the anticipation of the race or just being in it, I live for it and I love it.
Comfort zone. I like that, Gary. And so it's not tough for you mentally to be okay with the dangers. It's not like you have to really, you know, pump yourself up too much just because you love it and that's what you want to do. And so the fact that it is hard and it is dangerous, that never bothers you then?
Not at all.
How about you mentioned talking to the older riders and trainers. Who in the room mentored you back when you were first getting started? Did you have anyone who kind of took you under their wing and really showed you the ropes?
You know, not when I was young, but it was more later in my career. Like, I just lost the bug, and, you know, you'd ask a lot of questions to other riders. There wasn't one particular rider, but you'd always watch the Pink Eyes and the Shoemakers and, you know, Chris McCarron, Dalhousie, and you'd watch them, but I never got to speak with them. And when I went to San Francisco when I lost the bug in New York, and obviously Russell was the king there, and, you know, you're working hard. And I had a trainer that was in Seattle, was down in San Francisco for the winter. His name was Clint Roberts, and I'd get on 13, 14 horses every morning, team working really hard, and I was only riding 5 or 6 a week and winning races here and there. But, you know, you're young and you're looking for that break. And he came up to me and says, you know, you're a really good rider, but you need to go somewhere where you can ride more races to really polish off your skills. I said, yeah, you know, what should you suggest? He says, well, listen, I have 30 head of horses. My son-in-law has 30 head of horses, and we run in Longacres. Why don't you come up here with me to Longacres this spring, and you can ride first call on both of our barns?
Wow.
And at the time, I was 20 in 1989, and I said, you know what? I said, where I'm going to go? I said, this sounds like a really good idea. So he hooked me up with an agent, and it was probably the best thing I undoubtedly did in my career. I got up there and I went from, you know, I think the first day I rode 5 and I win 2. And from there, you know, by the second week of the meet, I was 10 in front of everybody and riding the cart every day.
Wow.
And when, I think I went 194 races the first year I was there in 125 days.
That was definitely a good decision, Gary. Definitely a good decision. And you were actually riding with another Gary up there, Gary Stevens, and you beat his record. Is that right?
Yeah, he wasn't there. He was in Santa Anita. I would go down in the wintertime when Seattle was done. I'd go down to Santa Anita and ride there in the wintertime. But his parents had horses in Seattle, and they kept, after the first 6 months I was there, they called him and said, listen, there's a kid here. We just adopted him as our third son, and he's going to break your record one day. And, you know, Gary had heard that story before. Yeah, Dad, sure, yeah, you know. And so I went down that winter, and met Gary in person for the first time, and we became very good friends. We're still friends to this day. And he said, well, my dad and mom think a lot of you, and they say you're going to break my record. And I said, oh, no, that would, I hope I do. I don't know if I can. And the third year I was there in 91, the second year I was there, I went 198.
Wow.
And the record was 233. And the third year there, I was just, I couldn't do anything wrong. But I'd went down to Santa Anita, right at the big boys, and just really polished myself off as timing-wise and understanding breaking down a race. And I talked with Lafitte all the time. I talked with Gary. McCarron was still riding. Delahousie was riding. And I got to ride in Shoemaker's last race. And I really tried emulating a lot of things they did, and would ask 100 questions about, you know, why you did this, you know, what was going through your mind, what did you do to set up for that? And when I went to Seattle that spring, there was weeks I win 17 races in 5 days. It was just, everything just come together, and I mean, just was doing everything right. And Gary called me after the year. He said, listen, don't break it by like one or two. I said, listen, I'm gonna shatter it, Gary. He says, please do. I did. I won 247 races in 125 days.
Wow. That's an incredible record. That's an incredible record. And you were just setting yourself up for success by, as you mentioned, going to Santa Anita, riding with the big boys, asking questions. And how is it? Is it easier to learn being surrounded by such good riders, riding good horses? It has to be easier learning versus, you know, just riding your average horse. But being surrounded by greatness, that has to be so good.
It was. I mean, and they were great guys. I mean, everybody wants you to be a good rider, but it's how hard you push yourself to get that good. And I always wanted to be the best of my abilities. You know, I didn't want to short myself. I didn't want to just be happy with average. I always pushed myself in any sport I did. And so I wanted to learn from them. And you know, to this day, I think there's things you can always be working on or fine-tuning or learning more about individual horses. I think has been a big factor in my career. I always wanted to know their tells, what they like, what they didn't like, and being able to use that in a race to the best of our abilities in that race to win. And I've always had a very strong work ethic about getting up in the morning and getting on horses, whether it's just to gallop them or breezing them going into their races. You know, I was never shy of working or working hard, and I think that's been a major factor in why I've been so successful.
It's one of the great things about our sport, Gary, is that you can learn something new every single day, no matter how long you've been involved, and it's a beautiful thing. And tell us, how many riding titles did you win at Long Acres?
I won 3 years in a row that I was there.
And that, by the way, was you were only the second rider in history to do that. And breaking records left and right, Gary. And where did you go from there? Where did you go from Long Acres?
Well, Long Acres was bought by Boeing, and they had one more year running at Long Acres. It was 92, and I decided to stay in Northern California. Instead of going back for the last year, I wanted to get established in Northern California. I broke the record in Seattle, and I was trying to go from Northern California, maybe work my way down to Santa Anita. And I went to Northern California in 92, and I was actually six winners in front of Russell. And unfortunately, I had a paddock accident. A horse slipped over on me and broke my ankle.
Oh.
But I'd gotten into Hollendorfer's barn, and you know, Terry Knight, Doug Utley, and Art Sherman was there, and I was riding for them. Walter Greenman was winning a lot of races, and Jeff Bondy was there, and I was doing really well. It was just unfortunate that the accident happened at that time, and you know, it's like I said, it's not when you get hurt, it's how bad. And I missed 3 months, and I come back, and you know, I did good, but you're always chasing Russell. You know, he's so tough to beat there, and from there, I ended up having some people call me and ask the racing secretary who they thought they wanted a good white rider that spoke English to come to Florida because it's such a Spanish-predominated colony. And then the owners were like, oh, we can't even speak to this guy. We don't know if he understands us or not. It'd be nice if there's a white rider. And a good friend of the racing secretary that was in Florida called the trainer that I was riding for, and he says, what about Boulanger? Do you think he would go? And when they asked me, you know, we're about 3 weeks away from going on the fair circuit, so they run Stockton, Pleasanton, Santa Rosa, Vallejo, and all that. And I said, you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea. You know, if it doesn't work out, I can come back for the big meet at Golden Gate or Bay Meadow, whichever it was. So I said, yeah, I'll go ahead and give it a try. So I went out to Florida and went to Calder, and I was leading rider the first 3 years I was there, just bang like that. Or just a very good career move, and I got in some big outfits there and won some really big races.
Again, making the right decisions, Gary. And was it tough for you, or did you enjoy traveling like that? Did you enjoy moving around, or did you have a family? Was it hard to move?
It was hard to move. I mean, I had a family, but I was going through my first divorce, and kind of was a way just to get a fresh start somewhere. And, you know, like I said, I had a couple months that if it didn't work out, I would have went back to California. But, you know, I caught on right away and did extremely well. And I adapt pretty easily. I'm a pretty, not a lot rattles me. I'm pretty, got a calm demeanor about a lot of things. And I adjust to new things quickly. And it was a pretty easy transition for me.
You mentioned, Gary, that they wanted someone who spoke English down there in Florida.
Right.
Was it tough for you going to a jockey colony that was primarily Hispanic? And during the race, obviously, we all talked to each other. Was it hard for you being surrounded by Spanish riders who pretty much probably only spoke Spanish during the race?
You know, it wasn't hard for me because, I always believed in what I was capable of doing and what my instincts were. And, you know, of course, in any competitive sports, you have your people that clash characters, and some riders ride a little more aggressive than others. And getting to know their riding styles and their tendencies took a little bit. But if you're winning races, people are knocking your door down for more and more business. And, you know, I was very fortunate that the people that I got into right away, we started winning right away off the bat, and it just escalated into more and more.
You mentioned learning the way the riders ride and their tendencies. So when you look at a race, Gary, do you handicap not only the horses' running styles, but do you handicap what the riders are going to do as well?
Yes. Go ahead.
And that comes with, obviously, having been established at a current meet, and then you get to know the riders. But do you focus on that when you handicap?
I definitely do. I mean, you have riders that are, obviously, there are some guys, you know, you have speed riders, you have closing riders. You know, everybody kind of categorizes what type of rider is. And you know your guys that are, they're pretty aggressive out of the gate, and horses tend to show a lot more speed with them than other riders. Is it because they're more aggressive, or is the horse set up differently? We don't know all those factors, but, you know, riders have a unique tendency of their comfort zones, and I've learned at a pretty young time in my career to let the horse tell me what they were wanting to do. You know, you get a horse that's happy and they're comfortable, they're going to run a lot further, they're going to run a lot faster. I was never one that was overly aggressive coming out of the gate unless I was asked to be. So some riders do, they're more comfortable being that way because that's how they learn and that's what they were always have been. So I'd always handicap knowing if now all of a sudden there's a speed rider on a horse that's usually way, way back. You know, he's going to be a lot closer to the pace just because of who's on him. I look at it. And then you got to handicap the track bias for that day as well, if there is one. So there's a lot that you have to think about before you even ride, and I take most of the factors into the equation and try to make the best judgment before the race, what it's going to be and adjust from there in a race.
So you mentioned, Gary, that you're not usually super aggressive out of the gate, but how would you describe your own riding style?
I'm generally a very keen closing rider, but over the years I've been known as someone who can relax a very aggressive horse. Everybody says I have great hands on a horse, but horses relax a lot more for me, finish up the races. Very good on closing horses.
How do you do that, get an aggressive horse to relax?
I like to get on in the morning and get to learn what their happy zone is, what shuts them off, which gets them in that comfort zone, what they don't like. Knowing that and knowing what I have to do and what I can't do makes it a lot easier. I mean, Lee Court was probably one of the last ones that I was very, there was a huge swing in her racing pattern after I started riding her. And she was a very, very aggressive horse that not a lot of people got along with. And I got along with her like, you know, peaches and cream. And it was just amazing. It was a lot of fun. And learning her in the morning. And then they get used to you as well. And I mean, she'd know when I came in the barn. She'd know when I was on her. She acted different. And the more I rode her, the more combined the team came, and I mean, we had a tremendous run. I mean, she got me to the Breeders' Cup a couple of years ago, which was a lot of fun to go back to that. But, you know, I also got to win a lot of big races on her. Win a race in Keeneland on her to qualify, winning during it race. And she went on every surface. I mean, she went on the poly, she went on the dirt, she went long, she went short. She was a lot of fun, but she was a very temperamental type of horse that I was, my riding characteristics suited her best.
Of course, Lee Court won the Grade 2 Thoroughbred Club of America Stakes, the Grade 3 Seaway Stakes, and the list goes on. Would you say that's mostly due to soft hands and finesse versus, of course, you can't out-muscle a 1,000-pound animal. So would you say that's just feeling the horse, kind of give and take, finesse?
With her, it was, you know, you never told her to do something. If you got after her early on, she would go faster than you can ever imagine. But if you try slowing her down, it was like, no, you want me to go, I'm going. So it was kind of getting along with her and letting her tell you how the race was going to unfold. So, I mean, I would sit as quiet as I could on her the first 50 yards. And she would tell me what's going on. I could be a half a length in front, or I could be head and head, or I could be two in front. And as long as I didn't do anything to encourage her to go forward, she would stay there. And once she started flipping her ears around, I knew she was waiting for me to ask her, is this okay, or I want you to do a little more. And once we got there, I'd wait all the way to the eighth pole if I could, and she'd always give me something. And I knew her cruising speed. I knew what kind of fractions I could set depending on the distance. And she was just one of those that you didn't tell early on, let's do this. Because if you did, she would go, which is, oh, you want me to do this? I'm going to do this my way then. And she kind of took over. If you just left her be, then she'd start listening to you.
Well, you two made a great team. Gary, we'll come back after this short commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Dance Through the Dawn has taken the lead. Toward the inside is Brushing Bully. Wind City is on the far outside. They hit the top of the stretch here at Woodbine. Dance Through the Dawn, a narrow lead. Brushing Bully to the inside. Wind City is all out on the far outside. Final furlong. Dance Through the Dawn. Wind City. One. Final acceleration. Dance Through the Dawn trying to hold on for 70 more yards. Like her mother. Like her brother. Dance Through the Dawn. A Queen's Plate champion.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I am Christina McManigal, and I'm joined tonight by jockey Gary Boulanger. Gary, we just heard the replay of your victory aboard Dance Through the Dawn in the 2001 Queen's Plate. Tell us about that race.
She was another kind of filly like lead court. She was very, very aggressive and did a lot of work with her in the morning, getting to know her, getting to settle and relax. And she was very precocious. And I rode her as a two-year-old the one time. Then she went to Kentucky with Mark Frosted, and she ran in an allowance race at Keeneland. She'd come for the Oaks. And in the Oaks, we drew like the two hole. And she ended up flipping in the gate, sent me out the back doors. I get back on her, and she gets away horribly. And she's next to last. She cruises through the field in the Oaks, and she wins by 2.5.
Wow.
So, you know, Frosted looked at me, and Wind City was winning all the colt races. He'd win, I think, the plate trial. He'd win two or three stakes in a row going into the plate. And Mark and I were talking about, you know, up here in Canada, you have the plate draw, and you'll draw your name out, and you pick what post you want, whatever is left over, you know, depending on when they pulled your name. So Mark had talked to me about, you know, what position I would want with her in the plate. And I said, well, how many is going in? He said, 17. I said, I want the 17 hole. He said, what? I said, I want to be there the least amount of time possible. And she has all the speed in the world. She's going to get away cleaner. I can control the race from the outside. There's a couple cheap speed horses. I don't want to get boxed in or somebody trying to squeeze me into a spot and get away bad and get shuffled back on the plate. She'll shut off for me wherever I want her. I just want that comfort of nobody on my outside and being in the gate as little time as possible. And I said, okay. So, you know, they drew our name like fourth. And Mark walked up there and said 17. The whole crowd had his big awe and it worked out exactly how I thought in the plate. You know, there's a couple speed horses that went out there, and I laid third to them. And Wind City was on my inside, and he took back off me three or four lengths, and I was just waiting for him to come to my hip before I asked anything of her. And about the quarter pole, I spotted him under my arm. I could see his silk coming, and she switched leads. I missed her, and you know, she accelerated all the way down lane, and he could never get to me. I think I beat her by 2 or 2.25. But she was one of those that you had to know as well, and she was pretty aggressive. But we got along well, and it was a great day. You know, the biggest career win in my career, and you know, I'm grateful I got the opportunity to ride such a nice filly.
Taking home the victory from the 17 hole. That's what an incredible story, Gary. And this was after you had moved back to Woodbine. Why did you make that move?
Well, Frosted had called me in 2000, Well, he had an agent call me. He's my agent to this day, Gary Templin. And the purse structure had gotten big, and I'd just come back from breaking my back in 99. I'd been back riding for about 2 months at Gulfstream. And, you know, Gary knew I was a Canadian citizen, and Frosted and Samson Farms were looking for another go-to rider because Todd Cable was the lead rider here, but he had a bad history of taking off unannounced for, he could be on three or four favorites, and he'd take off. So they wanted another rider that they could rely on these big races coming up. And I actually came up to ride Scatter the Gold in the plate that year. And when I got here, I worked them 2 weeks out from the plate. And Todd Cable kind of threw a little hissy fit with the trainer because he had rode the other half in the plate trial, but he wanted to ride Scatter the Gold, and he kind of pushed his weight around and his seniority being here, and they put Todd on Scatter the Gold at entries instead of me. And, you know, I didn't throw any fit and kind of swallowed it on the chin, and Mark said, "Don't worry, I'll make it up to you." I said, "Okay." That's when he gave me Dance of the Dawn as a 2-year-old.
He didn't make it up to you.
Yeah. But they'd asked me to come there. They wanted another go-to rider that Samson Farms were comfortable with and that they could rely on, that had good work ethics and was a good rider, and they called me.
Gary, tell me, you oftentimes you have to deal with things like that, getting taken off of horses or whatever it might be. Things just don't work out the way they're supposed to or the way you think, and that's racing luck. But you mentioned your calm demeanor. How do you take the highs and lows of the sport? Because they are extreme. They are absolutely incredibly extreme. How do you handle that?
That's just the way I'm made. I don't know. I mean, not a whole lot. I mean, obviously you get upset inside if different things happen, whether you get taken off a horse or not. If you don't get upset, something's wrong with you. I've learned over the years that, you know, it is what it is, and what will be, will be. I just keep working hard, and I believe in what I am and what I can do. And as long as I'm healthy and my kids are healthy, little things like that will work out.
Well, and Gary, you definitely must appreciate your health now, because let's talk about your horrific spill in 2005. Tell us what happened.
Well, I was in the Mac Medallion Stakes going 1 3/8 on the grass at Gulfstream. It was Gulfstream's first year reopening after they revamped the course and the track. And I didn't ride to the beginning of the meet. Unfortunately, my father passed away the beginning of January, and I flew back home to be with my mom and help her. And I actually just buried him on the 7th of January, and I got back like the 9th, and I started riding again on the 12th. And I rode in the race itself, I was on a horse I had rode for Vicky Oliver and Mr. Humphreys called In Hand. And I rode him in the William McKnight at Calder in December. And he's a big horse, and he was making a move. We were fourth, fifth, moving. Me and Joe Bravo were moving together, and I was on his outside. And I was in the second turn, and he's a big moving horse, and he hit a patch of grass at his front feet, and it just tore out from underneath him. And his front feet went one way, his back feet went the other way, and he slipped and catapulted me way in the air. And I landed on the inside, and two horses, they jumped him. He went, you know, he fell, obviously. And they went over top of him, and now I'm laying in front of them, and two horses run me over. One of them clipped the right side of my helmet and run over my whole left side. I broke all the ribs on my left side, some ribs on my right back side. I ended up rupturing my spleen and I had a subdural hematoma to the right side of my skull. That they didn't know any of this really, because I got up and walked around and was fighting with the paramedics. I didn't want to be put on the backboard. I said I was fine, but I had blood coming out of by my nose and my eyes, that I believe was my goggles that I did that, because I had blood coming out of my one ear. And I don't know all this, but this is all in the report, obviously. They finally got me down to the ground. They put me in seat spine. They had me on the backboard. They were going to send me for x-rays and observations. So when they wheeled me in to the emergency room, as they're backing the ambulance up to unload me, my blood pressure just collapsed. And they rushed me in, did a CAT scan. That's when they found the ruptured spleen, that I was bleeding out internally. So they have to do an emergency spleenectomy. And they removed my spleen, put some stents in, and as they're wheeling me out from doing the splenectomy, my head just swelled, poof. They put me back in the CAT scan again, and they find the subdural hematoma. So they have to go in for a second surgery. After all that happened, you know, obviously I was touch and go. They didn't know whether I was going to make it. The cranial pressure was so bad that they had no measure for it. They did an excavation hole, and usually they would do an excavation hole, and they go in and they remove the bleed. Well, the pressure is so bad, blood just shot all over. They were concerned that the cranial pressure was going to get so bad that I was going to die from it. And they end up removing the right side of my skull.
Wow.
And for the next, it was 28 days, I was in a coma. They put me in a coma to slow everything down. I ran a fever for a while. They didn't know if I was going to make it. And by about the seventh day, I started responding to the neurologist and the neurosurgeon the right way. But it was going to be a big uphill battle. I had vomiting issues. There's a portion of your brain on the right side that triggers vomiting. I couldn't keep anything down, more than a quarter of a cup of anything. And balance was tremendously bad. I couldn't do anything on my own. Walking-wise, I had people that would put belts on me, and I had to hold on to them. And it took me about 2 weeks after I came out of the coma where I could walk maybe 10 feet on my own.
Wow.
And once all that, you know, I was cleared from that. I had to go back 2.5 months later for the surgery to put the skull plate back in my skull and put all the plates on it and, you know, screw it back together. And from there, it was just massive migraines, light, sound. I didn't leave my bedroom for sometimes days at a time. It was an excruciating time in my life.
I can't even imagine having to go through that, Gary. And you were fortunate to be alive. You certainly weren't thinking about riding again, I'm sure. And you came about, you had seizures at a certain point as well, didn't you?
Yeah. It was a year after my second surgery. And I had the first melatonic seizure. And they scared the heck out of my wife at the time. They obviously, I mean, you look like a fish flopping around on the ground, and eyes roll back in your head, and you're foam at the mouth. And I ended up, you know, I woke up in the emergency room. And now I got to see your neurologist, and it's chemically getting you balanced. That's where things, your brain can function correctly. It's a short circuit, the way it was explained to me. And so they got me on medication for that. They thought we'd control it, and that lasted about just over a year before I had my second seizure, well on medication. So now changing medications, and all through this time, you're just in and out of doctor's offices, just dealing with these massive migraines and just trying to get you on the right medication for that. And obviously, you know, you're going through your mind, like, what am I going to do now? You know, my biggest question was, you know, if God didn't want me to be doing this, why did he leave? And now you're leaving me here to do what? What's my purpose? I went flatline twice on the operating table with when they did the skullectomy. So I didn't know. I mean, that was my biggest battle. Like, why did this happen? You know, you never want something you're so good at to be taken away from you the way it was, bothered me for a long time.
Just a horrific feeling. Not only are you dealing with the aftermath, the seizures, the migraines, but like as you mentioned, you had what you love to do was just taken away from you. And I'm here talking with Jockey Gary Boulanger, joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Gary, what did you think you were going to do?
I didn't know. I prayed to God. I thanked him for, you know, my kids being healthy and that, you know, just give me some guidance in what you're wanting me to do. You know, and things started happening where, you know, guy asked me about training horses maybe. And I'd been given some riding lessons to some kids that my children had a riding pony at. And I'd worked with some of them, and, you know, I was getting stronger. And the more I did, the more physically I did, the better I felt. And dealing with the migraines is starting to become easier to do. And I trained for a year. And, you know, all I know is horses. So, you know, I trained a few horses and had, like, 5 head at Calder, and I went to some races. And then you get, you know, some owners that kind of stiff you on pay, and, you know, it wasn't me. I tried to be an agent for a while and absolutely hated it. It was a lot of disappointments in people that you had been successful with, and you see the whole different side of being an agent now. They, you know, just because you were well-received as a rider, the rider you have may not be, and you know, there's a lot of lies and deceptions, and it was no fun to me. And I kind of bounced around.
Was it tough for you to be so close to what you loved? Was it tough to see, to work with riders, to train, to hire riders, to as an agent representing riders? Was it tough for you not to be able to just get a leg up and get on the back of a horse?
Yeah. Well, it was tough. I was galloping and breeding horses, but they wouldn't clear me to ride a race.
Wow.
So, you're trying to just let things go and give them insight onto what the horse liked, what they didn't like, and, you know, how I thought they should ride them. And some of them listened to me, and, you know, and I went some races. I was back around them, so it was better for me inside. They were kind of my healing tactics. Now I was back in that element. I wasn't riding, but I was back in the environment. I was back doing little things with the horses, and, you know, I was back in the race atmosphere, so it started getting fun again.
But it still had to be frustrating, and if a rider maybe didn't listen to your instructions trainer, and you knew what to do, but they didn't listen.
For sure. Well, it was grueling at times, and I just, but I knew they weren't me, so I couldn't expect them to ride the way I would have rode them. So it's easy to sit there and judge them, and that, you know, I never would get mad, but I would just, I'd think to myself, why did he do this, you know, like that. What was going on? What kind of reaction was the horse getting, given him that he did that. So, I mean, he got that unknown. So I never, ever blew up on a rider or screamed at a rider, you know, it was just, it wasn't our day or, you know, another day. And it was frustrating, but I still had a calmness about me because I thought I was going in a direction that I was supposed to.
So when did it come to you that you were going to try to get cleared to ride races?
I went from training to my girl I was dating, and I ended up marrying her. She had me come up to Ocala and learn about pinhooking horses. And I bounced around for like 2 years, and we did that. And Mark Cassie has a big string in Florida, and, you know, his home base is there, and buys a lot of two-year-olds. And he was looking for another breeze rider. And I've been galloping and breezing horses for like 3 years and getting on a lot of horses and working hard and breaking babies. And, you know, I went to work for him, and he said, man, you look great, Gary. And he's telling me to breeze in 48-1. I breeze 48-1, breeze in 59, or breeze in 102. And he still looked great, and he got me the clocks there. And he had a young 3-year-old that never started. And I've been galloping him kind of a handful of times, and I've been galloping him and getting along with him, and he's breezing. And I thought a lot of him. I said, this horse is a nice horse. I said, he's okay. And I said, this horse is a really nice horse. He goes, are you sure? I said, I'm telling you. So he had me breeze against a horse that had ran third in the Breeders' Cup Mile. He was a pretty nice horse called Delegation. My horse is a maiden. He's obviously a winner of state races, and we got walkie-talkies on with the earpieces in the breeze, and Mark says, it was good breeze, and, you know, so we're out there, and we're breezing. At the 8-pole, they came on the walkie-talkie. He says, all right, let him out. I just smooched this horse, and he opened up 5 on Delegation.
Wow.
He said, I said, Mark, not for anything, but if I got cleared to ride, would you let me ride this horse? He says, are you thinking about riding? I said, well, you know, I'm doing everything but, you know, I'm breaking babies, I'm breezing horses. If I'm going to get hurt, I could get hurt just as bad in the morning as I could in the afternoon. I says, it's what I know and what I love. I says, well, he said, if you get clear, Gary, you can ride that horse. I said, okay. Well, I've been, you know, already talking with my neurologist and that, and I had to do a bunch of tests, and they did all the tests, and everything came back clean. You're healthy, you're strong. There's no signs of seizure activity right now. They were uncertain what would happen if I pressed myself to that, exerted myself physically that hard in a race, if it would ever happen. And, you know, I promised them if I ever did, I would tell them, and I would walk away. And thank God nothing ever happened. And I ended up riding about 4 races before. I went to Tampa and rode one for Mark and a few other people, and they had the OBS races in Florida that Mark always runs, and he had another 3-year-old maiden that I'd been galloping, and we did a bunch of work on him. I really knew him, and, you know, he was a maiden against winners, and he said, I'm going to put you on this horse in the state race. You know him. I said, okay. He said, now all I want is a positive race here, something we can build on. You've been showing speed and stopping, so, I want a positive race. As long as he's running at the end, I'll be happy. I said, okay. So we're going 3/4 of a mile at OBS, and he breaks nice and quiet, and I do my thing, and he's like 16 lengths last at the half-mile pole. And Mark was just, his wife and him tell me a story afterwards. He says, I was calling you some naughty names. And at the 3/8 pole, here I come. I win the race by 3.5 lengths.
Wow.
And he said, I don't know what you do, but you got it. You're amazing. I said, thanks, Mark. I appreciate it. I just need good horses. He says, no, you are amazing. He says, what are you doing for the summer? I said, I don't know. I haven't put any thought into where I would go. I've been riding a little at Tampa, but I was just, you know. He said, would you come back to Woodbine? I would come back if I had a big barn like you behind me. I definitely would come back. He says, I'll ride you on half my barn. At least half. And we're going to Keeneland to ride the horse that
had brought this all, and his name was Kagan. He said, "You ride Kagan at Keeneland opening day." I said, "Okay." And Mark really got it all started where I was excited about a horse. I mean, just showed an unbelievable amount of talent in my book. He won a couple of grade ones in his career. That was how I got back to racing, was from Mark and a few particular horses. And from there, it's, you know, Mark and I have a tremendous relationship now, and he's a big backer of mine, and I'm very appreciative of what he's done for me.
Gary, I am just, my jaw's dropping open right now. We only have about 2 minutes left. We could talk for three more hours, but what an unbelievable comeback. And real quick, just describe that feeling when you won that stake at Ocala. Just describe that feeling, how it felt to finally win a race after so long, and you never thought you were going to get there again.
I mean, I probably had as much emotion that day as the day I win the plate. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps right now just thinking about it. Everything, you know, you're so happy, you're in tears, and you're like, thank you. I mean, this is what I'm supposed to do. And I mean, I cried like a baby, and it was an amazing feeling in a day. And the crowd that was there, they knew me from Calder, so a lot of the Florida guys were there. And I mean, they were just, even the announcer had made a bunch of comments about his first winner back. It's great to see him back in the winner's circle. It was an amazing feeling that you can't put any word on how it really felt. But I mean, I cried like a baby.
What an incredible story, Gary. And like I said, I wish we could talk to you for a couple more hours. I am so sorry we are out of time. But thank you so much for joining us, Gary. And we wish you all the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
If you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. You will also find a full schedule for every show on the Horse Racing Radio Network on our website. We bring you something new almost every day of the week. Again, check it out, horseracingradio.net. Now be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.